The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
The first we know about the nature of the bombs is that the bomb structure is right out of the ISIS playbook that they used in Europe. They used the same explosives. They used the same constructions of ball bearings and nails. The explosive itself, to me, was quite interesting because it's not the same explosive that the Tamil Tigers had historically used, or even that the South Asia groups, they tend to use RDX, and this was a very different explosive. So that, to me, was the imprimatur of ISIS. Where this does squarely intersect with the Sri Lankan domestic politics is what we're seeing right now, right, is the Buddhist community begins attacking Muslims. This becomes an ever more ripe place for further, I don't like to use the word radicalization, I tend to avoid it, but further recruitment on behalf of ISIS.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, May 18th, 2019. Christine Fair is an expert on South Asian politics and extremist groups. And you may have noticed that it's been a bad few weeks in Sri Lanka. A major terrorist attack, actually the largest since 9/11, hit multiple locations targeting Christians on Easter morning. The violence was different from the usual terrorism that rocks Sri Lanka from time to time, and I asked Christine to come in and talk us through it. What's going on in the island nation? How does it map on to the history of ethnic tensions between Tamils and Sinhalese? And what does it mean for the future of Muslim extremism in South Asia? It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 418, Christine Fair on the Sri Lanka attacks. So we had some terrorist attacks in Sri Lanka.
Yes.
Pretty big.
The biggest since 9/11. Initially, the Sri Lankan government said 350, but that's because of the ineptitude of the Sri Lankan government. The different ministries had different numbers, and they finally settled upon the magical number of 250.
So 250, it makes it bigger than Bali, the
yep.
Bali bombing. It's
yep.
bigger than the Spain. And it was a kind of a two-day story in the United States. Let's unpack it a bit. The targets were Christian targets, and it is outside of what we normally think of Sri Lankan terrorism, which is, you know, ethnic in character.
Right.
So who were the perps and what was it about?
So what was it about? It still remains an interesting puzzle because, as you said, for the longest time, the master cleavage in Sri Lanka was between the Tamil Tigers, and the Tamil Tigers were mostly Hindu and Christian, against the Sinhalese Buddhists, right? So
– and just so that we're – for listeners who don't know, the country is what, about 70% Sinhalese?
Yeah. So it's 22 million people. About three quarters of it, Sinhalese, 10% Muslim, 7% Christian, and the remainder are the Tamils, some of whom are indigenous to Sri Lanka and some of whom were brought to Sri Lanka during the British period of colonization. So after the Tamil Tigers were defeated in 2009 as a part of what the government called War for Peace, there wasn't any effort to have any kind of reconciliation with the Tamils. They just went full-out colonization. There's not going to be any reconciliation. We're not going to appease any of your grievances. And what came out of this was this really toxic Buddhist nationalism. And in fact, Sri Lanka actually has a Buddhist terrorist group called the Buddha Balasena, which literally means the Buddhist defense force. So after this, what the cleavage that began to emerge was Muslims and Christians being victimized by Buddhist chauvinists. So if you were to ask me a year ago, we were expecting a large Muslim mobilization, who do you think they would attack? I would have said they'd be attacking the Buddhists. And in fact, this group, the National Tawhid Jamaat, it's an indigenous Sri Lankan organization with ties to the comparable Muslim community in southern India, the last thing they were caught doing before this attack was defacing Buddha statues. So there were two immediate questions that came up for those of us that have been watching Sri Lanka. How did this organization go from defacing Buddha statues to the most lethal and coordinated attack we've seen since 9/11? And then also, why did they attack Christians? So many of us knew that there had to be an ISIS connection. And in fact, about between 30 and 40 Sri Lankans have gone to fight with ISIS. So this wasn't something that was beyond the pale. And the other thing that made it propitious was that in the fall, there was a huge falling out between the president and the prime minister. I mean, there was essentially a bizarre coup that was uncouped. And there's just a lot of friction between the president's office and the prime minister's office, which facilitated a lot of intelligence leaks or intelligence hints that they were given from different sources to just fall through the cracks.
All right. So before we get into the nitty-gritty of the attack, let's talk about the Christian community in Sri Lanka. It's relatively small and it's cross-ethnic, right?
Well, so generally speaking, the Christians, they tend to be Tamil, but there are Sinhalese Christians. But also it's cross-denomination. So virtually sort of Pentecostal Protestantism, where they do laying of hands at one end of the spectrum all the way to sort of your standard issue Catholic mass on the other. And I would also say that, you know, so they're 7% of the population of 22 million. The Muslim community is also equally diverse, or at least it was. But what's been happening over the last several decades has been this Salafist expansion and cultivation of previous Muslim spaces. And so the ideological diversity of Sri Lanka's Muslims have begun to change over the years. And you see it not only in the way in which women dress. Like the first time I went there in 2002, you never saw a woman in a black hijab with niqab covering her face or socks and gloves. It's ubiquitous now. And you also see men.
Ubiquitous in general, or ubiquitous among the 10% that's Muslim?
Well, I mean, among the Muslim. And it was also two things. Like one, it's a dependent variable selection issue because you only see the people that
of course.
Right? But if you see a group of women walking together, it's not as if you see one woman veiled and other women not veiled. And you tend to see groups of women veiled. If you go to other places that I've been to, you won't see that. You'll see mixed groups, like Indonesia, a great example of that. You'll see women in a group wearing all sorts of different attire. In Sri Lanka, you don't see that. And equally important, men too have begun wearing topis, you know, the skull cap, which was not so prominent either. So there are these visual markers. And this particular community that produced these bombers, and they were a particularly battered community. During the civil war with the Tamils in 1990 had a huge massacre at one of the mosques in this very locality. And what was interesting about them is because they tend to be multilingual, they speak English, Tamil, as well as Sinhalese, they were actually recruited into Sri Lankan intelligence because the Sri Lankan intelligence and the military had no translators for Tamil. So this put them very squarely, you know, really in the target sites of the Tamil Tigers. But then there wasn't really any reward for cooperating with the Sinhalese state because as this Sinhalese Buddhist chauvinism began to emerge, they became equal targets just as well as the Christians were.
All right. So with that as background, now we have this strange event in which, oppressed by the Sinhalese Buddhist chauvinist government, this particular cell, anyway, of Salafi extremists attacks Christians who are sort of, at some level, their kind of natural ally.
Yeah, exactly.
What do we know about why they were targeting churches?
So I think this is best explained that this was targeted as an ISIS target, right? So if we were to try to explain this by the logic of the domestic politics of Sri Lanka's Muslim community, we can't, right? The most obvious target would have been against the Sinhalese. So to me, this is the most clear sign of the imprimatur of ISIS, is that they're going after Christian targets. I mean, it would be utterly inutile from the ISIS master narrative for them to target Buddhists, right? Where does that even fit in their landscape of ideological grievances? Although, you know, empirically it should.
Yeah, and, you know, the Taliban did destroy the great Buddhist statues in Afghanistan, right?
But their logic was different, actually. So there's a more complicated backstory. One, at that point, Afghanistan, from their point of view, was an Islamic emirate. And they were more irritated. So actually, this was less of them going after a Buddhist target than it was. They were more irritated the international community wanted to preserve the Buddha statues than they were helping Afghans who were actually starving at the time. And this was really more of a thing of spite than it was going after Buddhist images per se. And what's also interesting about the Taliban, in contrast to Sri Lanka, just give you a sense of like how Sri Lanka is just so different. The Taliban never really targeted Sufi shrines. They understood that many Afghans are Sufis. They're Naqshbandis. They might have put locks and chains on them so that people couldn't worship at them. But they didn't go and blow up shrines like we've seen in Pakistan. We also saw it in Bangladesh long before we saw it in Pakistan. And we also saw it in Sri Lanka. And so when I look at South Asia, that for me is really the canary in the minefield. Because when Muslims begin targeting Sufis, it's a really important indicator that important Salafist-oriented groups are taking root. And the reason is a little bit complicated. So when I mentioned the name, the group's name, the local name, Tawhid was in the group's name. And what Tawhid means is unity. What Sufis do that so irritate these Salafists is that they put the Prophet really at the same level as Allah. And so for a Salafi, this is a kind of shirk because they're attributing to a human, which is the Prophet, attributes of Allah. And this is also why they think Christians are polytheists as well, because of the Holy Trinity. So one of the Salafi groups I study, they say, you know, Christians, they make one into three, the Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost, which I must confess, I don't understand myself, and I was ostensibly raised in this tradition. And Barelvis make one into two. So when you have Sufi shrines, particularly in communities where Sufis are probably the majority population, this is really a harbinger of bad news to come. And this had been happening in Sri Lanka. And in addition to that, in 2016, the community began naming these specific individuals to the security forces, saying that they've set up this organization. This organization is bad news. We're afraid of this organization. 2016, no one did anything.
All right, so let's talk about that, because I do think when you have an attack of this magnitude, one of the questions that always comes up is, was there an intelligence failure that led to it? And in this case, the answer seems to be heck yeah.
Yeah.
Which is, to me anyway, surprising. I'm not a Sri Lanka expert by any means, but I have always thought of the Sri Lankan Sinhalese government as pretty competent in the security space, and particularly in the Department of Surveillance of Potential enemies that they should be worried about, right? And they were pretty effective in that regard over a long period of time. And so to have them so completely drop the ball on this is a bit of a surprise to me anyway. And so my question, first of all, is, am I being naive and these people are actually less competent than I understood? Or is it that they're competent and serious about, you know, Tamil issues and they just don't have their eye on this particular ball?
So the answer to that question is also a little bit complicated and depends on the time frame. So probably around 2004, they began to be less incompetent. Up until that point, you know, I remember interacting with Sri Lankan military personnel, and they would tell me very, very forthrightly that they were afraid of Tamil women because Tamil women were very frequently involved in suicide bombing. I mean, this to hear a male soldier speak in such a way about a female combatant does not necessarily inspire confidence, because it's not as if these women in the Tamil Tigers were, in fact, you know, ferocious ninjas, right? But part of the reason why the international community also missed, by the way, them stepping up their game and killing Prabhakaran, the leader of the Tamil Tigers in 2009, is that everyone had just written them off as incompetent. And of course, everyone was focused on the global war on terror, right? They were looking at Iraq, looking at Afghanistan. And slowly and quietly, the Chinese were massively expanding the military, not only in terms of their numbers, which massive expansion, unprecedented expansion, but also skill transfer. And so the international community was equally surprised by Prabhakaran getting killed in 2009. So I would not say that they are terribly competent. I'll say that they had a lot of numbers, and they were also very vicious. And what we now know is just wide-scale atrocities were perpetrated to get Prabhakaran. And the situation in the north is still quite terrible. So I think it's a combination of things. One, brute force is how they got Prabhakaran, just straightforward brute force and mass casualties. And then the obsession with colonizing the North, putting military personnel there to try to change the demographic structure of the North became the interest of the state. So I think it really was a massive – we can't say an intelligence failure, right? Because they actually had the intelligence. I mean, actually, Hashim, the ringleader, was even identified in police reports that this community had given. So it's
well, that'd be the ultimate intelligence failure if you if you're sitting on the intelligence and you don't use it.
You don't
it.
Do it. I mean, so I was like, really?
Yeah.
It's
so
a
what did
act.
They? What did they know? The community, the Muslim community in Sri Lanka had fingered this relatively small group of people.
That's right.
Right. We're not talking about a mass movement.
No, it's a very small movement of a very small community, and in fact, this guy was so extreme that his extremist organization, which he founded, kicked him out of his own extremist organization, right? So this
that's
is –
That's what we should all aspire to.
I mean, exactly. Well, I think that's happened to me. I think I'm pretty radicalized. So when the newspaper – who radicalized her? Well, we know the answer. So I mean, he's a small community, a small portion of a small community, and the most radical of the radicals. So they're completely not representative. And the community was consistently saying – we are afraid of this. Now, the reason why the community was afraid of this is that they're not stupid. Everyone told me when I was last in Sri Lanka, who was Muslim, that they expected the next pogrom to be them. And we're seeing this now, right? On Monday, there were very large series of attacks on Muslim properties and Muslim communities. So they understood that if anything happened, especially to the Sinhalese Buddhist community, there would be hell to pay. And so they had this natural incentive to report this. But not only did they do nothing with these reports going back to 2016 in January, they found a very large weapons cache in a public park. And that should have been a very serious clue that something was amiss. And that wasn't the only – I mean, there were multiple large weapons caches. And again, they didn't put it together. The Indians themselves told them that stuff is going to go down with this group. And so not only did you have the strategic warning of 2016 over the last several months, you had increasingly salient reports that something bad and imminent is happening. Now, as we get to this more imminent set of warnings, the breakdown in the Sri Lankan government is probably the best explanation because, as I said, this tension. Basically, the president in the fall tried to get rid of his prime minister, Wickremesinghe, and replaced it with both of their previous rivals, Fonseca. Then there was a bunch of confrontation in the parliament. And then ultimately this – you can't really call it a coup. I'm not even sure what to legally call it when the president, without any constitutional precedent, just dismisses a prime minister with some person arbitrarily to supplant him. So after that crisis of governance between the president and the prime minister, the president and the prime minister, they just had different portfolios. It kind of reminds me a little bit of the so-called national unity government in Afghanistan, where the president and the chief executive have different portfolios. And in the siloing of these different portfolios, bad things happen. So that explains like the immediate screw-up, the immediate failure to put together something bad's happening from the weapons caches that were being detected and the Indian intelligence. But what explains the strategic failure from 2016, you can't put that on this governance crisis. This is something much more pernicious about ineptitude of the authorities. And they had all the evidence they needed just visually in front of them. I mean,
all right. So I guess there are a few major sets of concerns that this incident generates immediately. One is you have a country that's already has a extremely violent ethnic conflict that is, you know, dormant right now because one side has so totally won, but is, you know, the body count of which over the last 20 years is very, very high. And now you are layering on top of that an exogenous religious violence that is known in the rest of the, you know, to a considerable degree in the rest of the region, but is not an organic creature of Sri Lanka, right?
Correct.
And so my question now, when we think of Sri Lanka in terms of, you know, violent extremism and violent state response to violent extremism, we think in terms of ethnic conflict. Is this the beginning of we are now going to have to think of it as multiple layers in a kind of – I don't even know where else has this, right? I suppose Iraq, where you have an ethnic conflict layered underneath or on top of a religious conflict, and any given act of violence can be almost any combination of religious and ethnic directed at any other religious or ethnic group? Or should we understand this more as – hey, the ISIS folks are really crazy. They're crazy wherever they go. They're crazy in Paris. They're crazy in Belgium. They're crazy in Sri Lanka. And they can do really terrible things, but it's not the – we shouldn't map it on to the sort of organic state of Sri Lankan society any more than we do with respect to France or Belgium.
Well, so it's neither of those things. So what the first we know about the nature of the bombs is that the bomb structure is right out of the ISIS playbook that they used in Europe. They use the same explosives. They use the same constructions of ball bearings and nails. The explosive itself, to me, was quite interesting because it's not the same explosive that the Tamil Tigers had historically used or even that the South Asia groups, they tend to use RDX. And this was a very different explosive. So that, to me, was the imprimatur of ISIS. Where this does squarely intersect with the Sri Lankan domestic politics is what we're seeing right now, right, is the Buddhist community begins attacking Muslims. This becomes an ever more ripe place for further – I don't like to use the word radicalization. I tend to avoid it. But further recruitment on behalf of ISIS. And like I said, in 1990, the same community that produced these attackers had been attacked by the Tamil Tigers. And so – there was an interview that the New York Times published with one of the Muslims. He is the watch person of the mosque that was attacked in which large numbers of his family had been assassinated by the Tamils. And he said, you know, at the time, we weren't armed. But he didn't really answer his own question. Is retaliation for what they did to us appropriate? So this is very much, the targeting was very much ISIS. I mean, there's really no incentive whatsoever for this group to target Christians. But in doing so, it's really pouring, you know, bourbon, if you will, on, you know, simmering fault lines that are really quite combustible. And I do fear that unless the Sri Lankan government can do something quickly, that we are going to see more anti-Muslim violence. So a lot of people were critical when the Sri Lankan government shut down social media. I actually wasn't, because I've been spending more time in Sri Lanka, more time in Myanmar, southern Thailand. And the social media is primarily what's used to spread vicious, hate-mongering rumors that actually get people killed. And I felt that the Sri Lankan government was making the least bad of a number of bad choices, not putting out who did the attacks until people knew, probably forestalled some of the violence against Muslims that we're now just seeing as of Monday, right? So I think those moves actually save lives. I know a lot of people criticize Sri Lanka for that. I wasn't one of them.
All right. So let's talk about the Sri Lankan government, more about the response. You know, in the wake of, what was it, 2009, there were a lot of calls for them to be sort of conciliatory toward the Tamils. I think it's safe to say they were not.
Correct. Held accountable for war crimes. And instead, they put the generals out on diplomatic posts where they had diplomatic immunity.
Right. So, I mean, they didn't really do the reconciliation thing. They kind of did the victory dance thing. Is there any reason to expect them to be more nimble in this religious context, where it's not the sort of Sinhalese ethnic majority that's being challenged and attacked? It's another religious minority that, you know, is actually mostly Tamil. So their power is not being attacked here. What is being attacked is the sort of fabric of the state. And is there any reason to be optimistic about their being kind of more nimble and saying, hey, there are social conditions here that, you know, like the last thing this country needs is a kind of social war between Muslims and Christians, or between Muslims and Buddhists, in addition to all the societal tensions they already have? Or is it just not in the nature of the Sri Lankan government to, you know, look at underlying conditions that may be factors here?
So I don't think it's in their structural DNA to introspect like this. I mean, so one of the issues is that, as in India, for that matter, particularly in southern India, Muslims tend to be very well educated in Sri Lanka. They tend to be trilingual, as I said, you know, the Sinhalese, Tamil, as well as English. So whenever I've needed a translator to go between areas, I've gone with Muslim, because they can speak with me, and I don't know those languages. My languages are in the northern part of South Asia. Unable to get jobs commensurate with their education, they're going to the Gulf. It's the same thing that we're seeing in Kerala, the same thing we're seeing in southern Tamil Nadu, also in India. And it's when folks go to the Gulf that you see these wholesale changes in their community. And this is also where they have the opportunity to interact with nefarious actors. And it does appear that there's a component of this. One of the bombers, he was an aeronautical engineer. He had studied in Britain as well as in Australia. And it, by all accounts, he seems to have decided that he was going to become an Islamic State acolyte, not in Sri Lanka, but actually in Australia, where, you know, there's something about diasporas, when people can see more clearly the situation they have back home, and when they start making decisions about what they're going to do. So I think India and Sri Lanka really need to have some straightforward internal dialogues about how is it that we can continue to have a very well-educated Muslim population and then deny them access to jobs, which is actually driving them to go to places where they are, to use a word I don't like, but I can't think of a substitute right now, radicalizing.
All right. So on the side of the Muslim community in Sri Lanka, there is this migration, you know, the, as you describe, a back and forth to the Gulf and, you know, to that great radicalizing country, Australia, as well as, you know, Western Europe. The Saudis are pretty aggressive as well in exporting as well, not just importing Sri Lankans, but exporting ideology.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm curious how much that has penetrated the Sri Lankan Muslim community.
So I think it has quite a bit, because remember, these guys themselves were not poor. And that's something really puzzling about these ISIS guys, right? They're not poor. They tend to be well-educated. So they themselves cannot credibly claim in a direct sense to be discriminated against, right? It kind of reminds me a little bit of like the Weathermen. Right, they were certainly not underprivileged people.
Or Muhammad Atta.
Muhammad, you name a single group, but they're undertaking attacks on behalf of a community that they feel is aggrieved. But yeah, so most of like the Islamists that we can think of, right? Almost all of the 9/11 hijackers, Osama bin Laden himself, the group I study, Lashkar-e-Taiba. I mean, they're not the Lashkar guys are not incredibly well educated like the 9/11. But here's also another problem, right? These groups require people to be educated, right? So you might be a duffer, right? But you can't get a passport, you can't get a visa, you don't know how to live in a Western country like Germany or the United States, how to negotiate your way into a flight school. So there is a little bit of selection bias with these groups. Not everyone can make it to ISIS. Like, so for example, there's a fascinating study. One of the reasons why India appears to be so resistant, right? Because if you look at the numbers, like India has like 200 million Muslims and it's produced fewer ISIS fighters than Finland has.
That's amazing.
No, it is crazy, right? So, and one of the reasons is, according to my colleagues in India, is that it's just difficult for them to negotiate the process of getting a passport, right? The Byzantine bureaucracy.
Indian bureaucracy
thwarts terrorism, right? So there is this, when you see these levels of well-educated terrorists, you have to ask, well, for them to do what they did, they probably had to have some level of education.
But isn't part of the, you know, if you're an Indian Muslim with radical propensities, you don't really need ISIS because you've got Lashkar, right? You've got your sort of homegrown.
Well, no. So even there, Lashkar's not homegrown. Lashkar's in Pakistan. They still have to get themselves to Pakistan. And at first blush, the easiest route would be they cross over the LOC. That's actually the easiest way to get yourself killed because the Indians have been hardening the line of control. So the easiest way actually is you go to Nepal, which doesn't require a passport. And then you meet your ISI handlers and they get you your Pakistan passport and it becomes this very elaborate way. But even by that metric, very few Indians have committed terrorist attacks.
That's interesting. I mean, I think of like – I didn't mean that Lashkar was an Indian group. I just meant it has more salience to an Indian Muslim than does ISIS, which is based far away and which is – right, and it operates in India and it's focused on – the subcontinent and its Muslim grievances on the subcontinent in a way that ISIS is sort of focused on the whole world, right? So it just may feel more local.
So this is actually a funny thing about India's Muslims. So there's – I kind of think of India and so one of the zones overlap with Sri Lanka. There's really two zones, maybe now three, of Indian Muslim activism. So one is Kashmir and that's tied to this historical dispute of Kashmir, but more directly, it's tied to Pakistan's explicit attempts to initiate first and now sustain an insurgency. And what it's done is that it's propped up certain groups, and when that group failed to meet their objectives, they put in another group. And so they're constantly playing these groups off of one another. But then you had this relatively different phenomenon that mostly took place among India's educated technology. I mean, these are people who work for Yahoo in the United States, in the southern states, very far removed from this Kashmir conflict. And they started out as the Students Islamist Movement of India, Simi. Then they morphed into the Indian Mujahideen. And then from those same communities, we had people going to join ISIS. Remember, these are really, really small numbers. And it's in those southern Indian communities that we have this overlap with these Sri Lankans. But both ISIS and al-Qaeda have been competing in South Asia. So you see al-Qaeda and ISIS chiding Indian Muslims, for example. Why are you only caring about your domestic issues? You should be caring about other issues. And also, oh, by the way, they keep taunting them. Why aren't you doing terrorist attacks? You've got this Muslim hater is the prime minister. You have this rise of Hindu chauvinism. Muslims are being lynched, not even for possessing beef, but, you know, for the allegation of possessing beef. So yet al-Qaeda and ISIS have not been able to get a firm foothold. There hasn't really been, I mean, there have been attacks thwarted, but there really haven't been ISIS or al-Qaeda attacks in India. Now, this going back to the Sri Lanka case for a minute, where you have ISIS, you will also have al-Qaeda competing because they're very much in competition with each other. We see this in Bangladesh. Bangladesh has very active local groups acting on behalf of ISIS as well as al-Qaeda, Indian subcontinent, and they're competing. And we actually see Bangladeshi terrorism becoming somewhat less underwhelming as a consequence. They actually have introduced in recent years suicide bombing, something they didn't even have, including female bombers. By the way, this is also something that we saw in Sri Lanka, female suicide bombers. You know, in the scheme of outside of Palestine and the Black Widows of Chechnya, both ISIS and al-Qaeda have not really encouraged women to take those kinds of roles.
All right. So trying to bring this around here, when you were last on the podcast, if memory serves, we were talking about Bangladesh.
Yeah.
And your warning at the time was keep an eye on it because there's actually a storm brewing.
Yeah, there was just another attack in Dhaka a few weeks ago.
And so my question is, are we looking at a storm brewing in Sri Lanka as well, or should we think of this as more probably a kind of dramatic, isolated incident or semi-isolated incident? And for that matter, are we looking at a storm brewing in India, where, after all, you do have a very large Muslim community, the largest in the world or other than in Indonesia? And by the way, you do have a Hindu nationalist prime minister who, you know, whose political charm in a very Trump-like way is the antagonizing of the Muslim community. And so should we look at this as a harbinger of, you know, sort of major developments to come in the attraction of, you know, some small percentage of these Muslim communities to groups that are, like ISIS and the al-Qaeda competition to ISIS? Or should we look at it as something that's going to be there but is likely to be very under control?
So, A, you can never rule anything out, right? So what happened in Sri Lanka was just years of neglect of the local Muslim community saying, we have a problem, and just a refusal to act upon it for reasons that are really inexplicable. Although one Sri Lankan official did try to throw in this ex post facto justification saying, well, we told them that we want you to just keep an eye on them. We don't want you to like expel them from your community. It just seemed to me to be sort of just rationalization of epic ineptitude. So going back to Sri Lanka for a minute, I can't rule out more of these kinds of attacks. Except in one narrow way, the guy who was the leader of this group blew himself up, right? Usually, in the groups that I've studied, the leaders don't blow themselves up, right? They justify it to their followers. I got to arrange more attacks, right? So if I blow myself up, who's going to replace me, right? So
Jonestown was the end of the Jim Jones movement.
Right, exactly, right? So this may have been a really bad move in many ways because the leader of this group blew himself up. So, but we don't know is who was left behind, right? I mean, how many other people have gone to Syria. We just have really no idea. And the Sri Lankan government has not impressed me in its competence. I mean, here they were. I mean, they literally had everything they needed to prevent this. And they literally did everything to not prevent it. Now, going to the Indians are really different. Like the Indians, they are afraid of their Muslim community. And a number of years ago, I mean, I travel all over India and I've interacted with different police officials. And the Indians are not insouciant. I mean, they view their Muslim population as basically, they call them Chota Pakistan, so small Pakistans. Now, that's actually very alienating if you're a Muslim, right? Because there's no evidence that Indian Muslims are anything but patriotic citizens. They serve in the armed forces. They serve in the police. And to have Muslim communities labeled like this is obviously a problem. But unlike the Sri Lankans, who just didn't seem to care, oh, the Indians care very, very deeply. And the police, they have active informants. So in the sense that Sri Lanka, you can chop this up to just massive – we don't have words to describe the ineptitude of the Sri Lankan state. The Indians are just the opposite. Like they're really keeping an eye on these guys. So if something were to happen in India – I mean, for example, it was the Indians that gave them the intelligence about this attack, right? So I don't see the Indians letting something like this just slip through their fingers. But is it out of the question or impossible? No. But also, each of the Muslim populations, so this is what makes India, I think, a lot more difficult than, say, Sri Lanka. One is just this geographic space, right? So Sri Lanka is actually a small country. You can go from Colombo to Batacola in like 2.5 – the roads are crappy. But it's a much more navigable, small place. In India, if you live in Kerala and you're a Muslim, you have nothing in common with folks in Uttar Pradesh. You don't even have a common language in many cases. So that makes it very difficult for folks within India to sort of aggregate, right? They'll tend to aggregate along these ethnic lines so they don't have a common language, which is why this diaspora stuff becomes so important, right? Because they would ordinarily never meet a Muslim from Uttar Pradesh who has a grievance unless they're hanging out in some diasporic location. So diasporas are particularly potent because people that would ordinarily never meet will meet.
Christine Fair, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. We've been reaching a whole lot of new listeners recently, and that's thanks to all of you who have been sharing the Lawfare podcast on Facebook, on Twitter, on Instagram. I don't know how you share the Lawfare podcast on Instagram, but you should be. And on Pinterest, and on Reddit, and on all those other social media sites that I've never even heard of. Thanks to everybody who has rated the Lawfare podcast and reviewed the Lawfare podcast. Thanks especially to those of you who are walking around every day in Lawfare swag, which you can buy at thelawfarestore.com. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. Audio engineering this week from Matthew Kahn. The Lawfare podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. And as always, thanks for
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kayla Itzinas.
I'm Kayla Itzinas, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.